I do. All right, so we're going to learn tonight, as an introduction to what we're going to learn tonight, we need to have a lesson in, how shall I phrase it, Hasidic blind faith. What I mean by Hasidic blind faith is that many things in Judaism could be understood rationally, and according to many could even be proven rationally. Mystical things, on the other hand, very often, although they can answer philosophical questions, which is why you have, you know, even secular philosophers that have mystical concepts, but very often they can't be proven rationally, even spoken about rationally. But then you have certain things in Hasidism that demand of you to be absolutely, like the Baal Shem Tov said, ich gläubt wie ein Narr, to have faith like a child, to literally have like blind faith like a child. That there's, I don't have extra sheets. If you could, people could double up.
It's a good problem.
Hashem should help further. So there are certain things in Hasidism that demand of you to absolutely have blind faith. That there's no way to prove them, and not only is there no way to prove them, very often when you hear certain things in Hasidism, you're like, oh come on, you're joking. You don't really expect me to believe that, right? And that's what separates the men from the boys, or the women from the girls, however you'd like to say. That it really takes, you know, a leap of faith to really believe that what these things are saying are real. In my opinion, and again, this is I'm completely subjective. I've drinking the Kool-Aid, so I'm not talking now from a rational perspective. But from my opinion, sometimes these what seem to be, oh come on, you must be kidding, Hasidic ways of interpreting, in my opinion, are the only ones that make sense. Because otherwise it's so ridiculous. The opposite. Not believing in these things, in my opinion, is more ridiculous. And this week is a perfect example. Because this week's parsha, probably more than any other, when you speak about the relationship between Yaakov and Rachel, everyone here is from, when you speak about the relationship between Yaakov and Rachel, and the whole soap opera that happened this week, if you look at it in any other way than the Hasidic, well, it's not just Hasidic, the truth is already from the Zohar, so it's Kabbalistic. I think that's the, I don't want to say immature, but immature way of looking at things. And I'll give you an example, okay? It's an example, it's not my parable to explain how, like, the Zohar, the Kabbalistic way, is really the only way of looking at things. It's not my parable, it's a parable of Rav Yoel Kahn, the great Hasidic teacher. So he once gave the following parable. That one time in the town of Dvinsk, now anyone that knows the history of the Jewish great leaders of the Jewish people, so they know in Dvinsk, at the very end of the 19th century and beginning of 20th century, there were two great luminaries. There was the Meshech Chochma, Rav Meir Simcha Kohen from Dvinsk, who was one of the greatest Lithuanian rabbis of all time, and there was the Rogachover Goyim, the genius of Rogachov, who was probably the greatest genius in Europe at the time. That's already, you hear, you know, and he was Hasidic. He was connected to the Chabad, Hasidic, whatever. So you already heard who got my vote. So one of the things, the favorite pastime of everyone in the town is that everyone was always arguing who's bigger, the Rogachov or the Meshech Chochma. The Litvaks were all saying that the Meshech Chochma is bigger, the Meshech Chochma is greater. And the Hasidim always would say that the Rogachov is bigger. Right? And this was like a perennial debate that was going on in Dvinsk all the time. And the anecdote is that there was once a little child that was sitting in a base medrash. A little kid, you know, a 7-8-year-old kid was sitting, and he hears this huge debate going on. All the chassidim are saying, the Rogachov is greater, the Rogachov is bigger. And the Litvaks are all saying, nein, the Meshech Chochma is greater, the Meshech Chochma is bigger. The back of it, he's bigger, this one's bringing a proof, he's bigger. And the 8-year-old kid starts laughing. He starts laughing. They look at the kids like, what's so funny? He said, what are you arguing about who's bigger? Was dingst de welch is groyser? They would walk together because they were good friends. It's always the followers that have the issues, right? It's always the chassidim. But the rabbis themselves are good friends. I saw them, they were walking together. And the Meshech Chochma is a sachecher. The Meshech Chochma is much higher, much taller. He's almost a head taller than the Rogachov. What are you arguing who's bigger? I myself saw that the Meshech Chochma is much taller than the Rogachov. So they said to the kid, Nein, Fashtaisnish, Mezot, Gresser, when we're arguing who's bigger, Mamainish the goof. We don't mean in body. We mean in stature and mind and genius. So the little kid laughs immaturely and says, "Ah, this is a pshetel." What do you mean stature, genius? Bigger means bigger. Pshutei shel mikra. Ein mikra yotzim de pshutei. Bigger. What's mean bigger? Bigger means bigger. And you try to explain to an 8-year-old kid, no, bigger doesn't mean bigger. Bigger means in stature and genius. An 8-year-old immature kid will never buy it because for him, rationally, the word bigger means bigger. So you say, Shlomo HaMelech married 1,000 women. And the Kabbalah teaches, including non-Jewish women. And Kabbalah and mysticism teaches he wanted to bring about the Messianic era and spread the light of God by marrying all these women. So the little 7-year-old, who might have a white beard, goes, "Oh, come on, you must be joking. 1,000 women means 1,000 women. That's Haxan, 1,000, the Tzoytzis, Mashiach. Right? Come on, that's a pshetel. That's a pshetel. Right? That's not really what it means. It means 1,000 women. It means he desired women. That's what it means. The Pasuk says he did. David with Bathsheba. Right? Or Yehuda with Tamar. So the mystical works will say that it was all messianic revelation, whatever. And the 7-year-old kid laughs smugly and says, "That's a pshetel. Pshat, we know pshat means, it means bigger, shteis." So you could either drink that Kool-Aid and understand that all these tzaddikim, in my opinion, it doesn't make sense. Why would the Bible so talk about all these things unless there were tremendous mystical, godly things going on? So of course there's the usual explanation that the Bible tells the faults and the mistakes and the failings of our leaders to show that they were people too and we could be like them. Fine, you want to say that? Bevakasha. But to say that that's why God wrote the Bible, just to show that if you screw up, you're okay, you're in good company. You're not the only one. I mean, it's a nice lesson, but to say that that's Torah's emes. So we come this week to Yaakov, and this week is all about Yaakov seeming to fall in love with Rachel. And the first thing he does when he sees her is he kisses her, which we're not going to get into, but if you'd like to take a look at Tanya chapter 45, there's a whole chapter of Tanya dedicated to explaining what that kiss was about, why Yaakov kissed Rachel. It had nothing to do with bigger means bigger. It was all about connecting the higher spheres. Take a look over there. Connecting different divine attributes. But we're going to learn tonight that what Yaakov loved Rachel, and the Torah says clearly he loved her because she was beautiful. Rachel ha'isi yifas ter v'yifas mare, ve'yeov Yaakov is Rachel. Einele, Leah was quote-unquote ugly, whatever that means, which we'll get to, Mitzvashem, we will get to. Whatever that means, this ugliness of Leah. For some reason, Leah was ugly. By the way, we're all probably descended from Leah. This matriarch of ours, who's the ugly one, quote-unquote. Which again, if you look at it like, you know, and Rachel is the beautiful one. And that's why Yaakov loves her. So you could read that. Beautiful means beautiful. Bakasha. So I'm not going to argue with you because the Taka says, Ifaster Ifasmar. But tonight we're going to learn the blind faith, mystical, Kabbalistic explanation and to understand what beauty is all about. Why is beauty, what beauty really means. What beauty means philosophically, what beauty means mystically, what beauty means in our lives. You know, there's a famous quote from Aristotle. To ask why concern ourselves with beauty is a blind man's question. So beauty is a thing, and to deny it is silly. And yet, King Solomon himself said, Sheker achein vehevel ayoyfi, which obviously there he is talking about physical beauty. And we understand that when we're talking about Yaakov Avinu, who is a soul from the world of Atzilus, beauty doesn't mean just beauty. Big doesn't just mean who's bigger. So let's look inside, and we're going to begin right away from a sentence from the Zohar that's right away going to dispel any conception of a question about something I said until now.
No,
just a question. Just a question.
More,
I'm running. Yeah. What?
Oh,
that's a good question. Okay.
Sure,
someone,
sure,
if we could.
Sure, sure,
sorry. Okay. So this Zohar will right away dispel a notion that somehow Yaakov, that Yaakov's love of Rachel had to do with physical beauty. So take a look at the Zohar at the beginning of the page. Source number one. By the way, don't worry about all these crazy numbers and lines. It's just the way that my mind works. but we're not going to read all of them inside. But the reason I did it, I have always people saying that they like when there are source sheets, and then people say they don't like when there's source sheets, so I try to do happy medium. I'm going to mainly speak outside, but to be able to look at it inside if you want to follow as well. So look at source number one. This is in English, so we're okay. Says the Holy Zohar, Reb Shimon said, Reb Shimon Bar Yochai taught that Yaakov had to deal with trouble all his life, and his days were troubled right from the beginning, and until he went down to Egypt. He had a troubled life. Right? So the Zohar begins by saying Yaakov had a troubled life. But we know that when, this is by the way, the Zohar in Parshas Vayechi, at the end of the book of Genesis, which we know, of course, we all know that Yaakov, the last 17 years of his life, what does Rashi, everyone says, were the best years of his life, when his trouble ended. His trouble ended. All his heart, he lived 130 years, which were, he himself said to Pharaoh, they were difficult years, horrible years, all of a sudden the last 17 years were the mamish geshmak. Now here the Zohar is going to say, why were they such wonderful years? Says the Zohar, when he saw Yosef standing before him, Yaakov looked at Yosef, and his soul was made whole, as if he saw Yosef's mother. Why? For the beauty of Yosef resembled that of Rachel, and it seemed to him as if he had never known any sorrow at all. It was the beauty of Yosef that fixed everything for him, because it looked like the beauty of Rachel. Now that's weird. That's really, really weird if you understand that bigger is bigger. It's not even Freudian. It's like even more skewed than Freudian if you understand that mamish, that bigger means bigger, right? That his sorrows were finished because Rachel had beauty, but he lost that beauty. But then you saw Yosef, and his beauty was... Now, by the way, you also know, it's not a mistake, there's only one man in all of the Torah that the Torah says was beautiful. Who was that? Yosef. Yosef in Parshas Vayeshev, Yifei Tov, Yifei Mar, it says he was beautiful as well. And you understand that if the Zohar is saying that that beauty was the same beauty as in Rachel, we already see from the Zohar that the completion of Yaakov's life wasn't even the beauty of Rachel, it was the beauty of Yosef that reminded him of the beauty of Rachel, and then he was fine. He didn't quote-unquote miss Rachel anymore because he had the beauty of Yosef, and look at the words of the Zohar. It seemed to him as if he had never known any sorrow at all. His whole life was perfect now. What the heck does that mean? It can't be bigger is bigger. You ready from the Zohar? So like this. Look at verse number two. The Pasuk says in this week's Parsha as follows. We're not going to read most of the text in Hebrew, but this one we will. This is a Pasuk in this week's Parsha. Ulelovan shtei bonos. Shem hagdoyla Leia, v'shem haktana Rachel. Lavan had two daughters. The name of the bigger one was Leah, and the name of the small one is Rachel. But the Zohar says, see, this explains, based on the Zohar, I made those letters big. You could also read this pasuk as follows. Lavan had two daughters. Shem, Hay, G'dayla. The bigger Hay, the name of the bigger Hay is Leah. V'shem, Ha, Hay, K'tana, the smaller hay is Rachel. What does that mean? The bigger hay and the smaller hay. So we know, of course, it's referring to the four-letter name of God. It's the name of God, which, of course, the name of God means the way that God reveals himself and manifests. That's what the name of God means. And in that name of God, the way God reveals himself and manifests, there's a higher hay, a higher way of him manifesting and revealing himself, and a lower way, a smaller way of God revealing himself and manifesting, and that's Rachel and Leah. Does anyone here daven with a sitter that has in a tikkun chatzos? Does anyone here say tikkun chatzos? Yeah? My Rabbi Weinberg always says, what?
I haven't seen it very many times.
My Rabbi Weinberg always says, the tikkun chatzos never made it across the sea to America. Like it stayed back in Europe. It's like it's a dying art. Unless you're like a Breslover. Like the, you know, they still have that sweetest prayer, the sweetest hour, you know. I think what
Tishabav
you say, Tikkun Chatzos. I think I've said maybe like 10 times in my life. Tikkun Chatzos is the prayer they're supposed to say at midnight to cry for the destruction of Jerusalem. Does anyone know what the two parts of the Tikkun Chatzos prayer is known as? Tikkun Leah and Tikkun Rachel, the rectification of Leah and the rectification of Rachel. Tikkun Chatzos, the building of Jerusalem, is rectifying Leah and Rachel. Why? Because what's a Kabbalistic way of saying building Jerusalem and bringing Mashiach? Rectifying God's name. Because God's name means the way he reveals himself and manifests. And all of creation, all of the purpose of reality, is to rectify God's revelation and manifestation. Which means to rectify Leah and Rachel. Leah is the bigger hay, Rachel is the lower hay. Now, I'm going to throw out a couple of terms. We're going to, and I have them inside. You could follow inside if you want or not. And then I'll explain a little better. Now, these are the next two quotes from the Alter Rebbe, from the Bala Tanya. Number three, what the Alter Rebbe explains, is that the higher hay of God's name is known as Shechinti Ilah, the higher Shechina, and the lower level of the lower hay of God's name is the lower Shechina. The higher Shechina, Shechinti Ilah, the higher Shechina and the lower Shechina. Let's say that in simple English. What is higher Shechina and lower Shechina? Shechina means the way God reveals himself and manifests. That's what Shechina means. Shechina means the way God reveals himself and manifests. That's the definition of the word. So there's the higher hay of God's name and the lower hay. And then look at number four. The Alter Rebbe right away gives a mashal, a parable to explain within ourselves, because we know we mentioned this last week. By the way, tonight's class is in some way, if you heard last week, it's a continuation. If you didn't, you're fine. But if you did hear it, it's a continuation. So we spoke about last week this idea also, that the only way we could really understand anything about God or relate to aspects of God is if we see how we manifest and reveal ourselves. The way we manifest and reveal ourselves is a mashal, is a parable, the way God manifests and reveals himself. You know why? Genesis chapter 1. We were created in the image of God. Therefore, our soul is an image of God. Or deeper, according to Chassidus, our soul is God. So it's just a microcosm and macrocosm. So in source number 4, the Alter Rebbe says as follows, that what's this higher hay and lower hay? The Alter Rebbe says that Leah and Rachel is oisis hamach, you could either follow inside or not, oisis hamachshava v'oisis hadibor, the letters of thought and the letters of speech. Leah is the letters of thought. That's the higher hay of God's name. Rachel is the letters of speech. That's the lower hay of God's name. Also known as, a.k.a., he now quotes from the Zohar, Alma Diskasya and Alma Disgalia. The hidden world and the revealed world. What does that mean? That's a very simple. Think for a second. How do you reveal yourself? With your thought or with your speech? Speech? You don't reveal yourself with your thought?
Unless you act
on it. Think a little deeper for a second. What's that?
You reveal yourself to yourself.
Of course. You don't reveal yourself with your thought? Sure you do. To yourself. Think for a second even more. Where are you more revealed? In your letters of thought or your letters of speech? Where are you more revealed? Revelation doesn't always mean to the other. You know, anyone that meditates knows that sometimes being able to access letters of thought is the greatest revelation there could ever be. To self. And the more you access letters of thought, the deeper a person you are. It might be, and I'm going to get a little of the punchline, it might be ugly, quote unquote, because you're not giving yourself to the other. It might be within self, but it's a deeper revelation of self. The other doesn't partake of it. And the opposite, the more you're lost in your thoughts, or if you're a person that likes to sit by yourself in a room and think, you could ask my wife how pleasant that is for the people around you, right? Because sometimes when you're lost in your own thought, you can't converse and don't want to converse with the other. Right? People that are people of thought like to be by themselves sometimes. So therefore, the ugliness has to do already, you see that there's something with letters of thought that doesn't allow revelation to the other. But you understand why already Leah is connected to the eyes. The Torah speaks about Leah's ugliness has to do with the eyes. You already understand that eyes are connected to thought and eyes are connected to depth. Because there's not just the physical eyes, there's eyes that's much deeper, the eyes of self, where one sees oneself. Now we know also, why does the Zohar call it the hidden world and the revealed world? Well, think about now with you, if you, there's letters of thought, which is a revelation of self to self, and letters of speech is revelation of self to the other, how does that pertain to God? What are the two ways God manifests as worlds? What are the two hays? The two ways that God manifests himself as worlds, the hidden world and concealed world, if you're thinking about that, they're letters of thought and letters of speech. What are worlds like that are created from God's thought? What do you think they're like? What's it like to live in that world? Spiritual is an understatement, right? Not just not physical. Think more than just not physical. What does a creature in that world feel like? If you're a letter of God's thought,
part of God.
Well, if you recognize that.
But if you're created as in the hidden world, as part of the hidden world, you can't not recognize that. We are letters of speech. Genesis chapter 1, that God created the world through speech, is the revealed world, is the lower hay, is malchus, is speech. That's why we might not realize that. That's why we have what's called free choice, which I hate using the term free choice because it's just so blah. It's not a question of free choice. Free choice is just a result of our existential ontological state of being, that we're God's letters of speech. And therefore we feel as the other from God unless we close our eyes, say the Shema, and meditate for about an hour. Or a minute if you're really good. So now, Yaakov is seeing Yaakov, who we're going to learn about, that Yaakov's whole purpose in the world is to bring the Yud of God's name to what? Where does Yaakov want to bring the Yud of God's name? To the Akev, the heel, because that's his name. He was born holding Esav's heel. His whole purpose is to bring God's light to where? To here. And where's here? Not just this beautiful shul. Esav's heel. Yud to the Akev, to the heel, to the house of the rising sun, to the as low as you can go. That's Yaakov. And he sees two hays in front of him. He sees one woman who's all about becoming enraptured within the divine, who's hidden within God, who's the higher hay, who's the letters of thought. And then he sees a woman who's all about the lower hay, the revealed world, which is all about what? Bringing God's light to where? To this world. Revealing God, that this letters of speech shouldn't remain a heel. It shouldn't remain letters of speech. That this world, this manifestation of God, which is manifested as something other than God, should be connected to the Yud. And he sees Rachel, who is that lower hay. He loves her. He wants her. Look at number 5. This is also from the Zohar. And here we get really, look at this. I'm not going to explain all the words here, but you'll get the gist. And Jacob loved Rachel, the latter, Rachel, being also termed the revealed world. That's from the Zohar. That's the letters of speech like we just learned, as is known. For the revelation of light is from the relation of her light is from Zerampin's chest down, which just means the Godhead, from the lower level of the Godhead, which means how God reveals as created beings that we know, as a world where there is a possibility of not feeling God at all. Leah's stature, in contrast, is from the chest of Zerampin up, for there the lights are covered. She is therefore termed the hidden world, the higher head. Now get this sentence. You ready for this? This is the Zohar. And God saw that Leah was hated. From here we derive that a person detests the nakedness of his mother. How do you like them apples? The fact that Yaakov hated Leah, she was hated. Not just in the beginning he didn't like her, but then he hated her after he was tricked, quote unquote. He hated her. Why? Says the Zohar. What do you mean? From here we hear that a person detests the nakedness of his mother. Talk about Freudian, right? What does that mean? What does that mean, the nakedness of his mother? So anyone that has learned Kabbalah at all knows that in the four letters of God's name, so Yud represents the beginning of the revelation of Ein Sof, Hey is the mother, Vav is the son, last Hey is the wife. So if we're usually the Vav, which is all about drawing down God, Hey is our mother, the first Hey is our mother, the last Hey is the wife. What that means, we're going to learn. And it's gender fluid. If you're, it doesn't matter if you're man or woman, it doesn't matter. So what does that mean that that's the mother? So we're going to have to explain, but you already understand up here that this isn't just big means big. This isn't about bigger means big, because Yaakov not loving Leah was because a man detests his mother, being with his mother. What does that mean? So now we're going even full speed ahead. We're going to deeper emunah. Ever wonder why Lavan's name was Lavan? What does Lavan mean in Hebrew?
White.
Ever wonder? That, I'm sure when you were a kid at one point, but then eventually like, yeah, just his name was Laban, whatever. So Chassida says there's no such thing as whatever. I mean, there is, but not in Torah. So the verse in source 6, the Alter Rebbe says that Yaakov says to this Lavan that had the two daughters, I will serve you for 7 years, which of course refers the seven is the Vav and the Hay, right? The 7 days of creation, which is the Vav and the Hay, 7 years. Why will he serve Lavan? Ki Lavan u bechinas Levin elyon makar chasadim shekol racham and pshutim leismal of hayatika. Lavan is keser. Lavan means white. You know why he was called white? Because Lavan means God. In the Torah, at the highest level, when you read the Torah the way that it was written before the physical world was created, because the Torah, even the Ramban says, is the names of God, Lavan is God's whiteness. It's God as he is in his Ein Sof. In simple English, before he reveals and manifests. Lavan is the whiteness before he reveals himself and manifests. When he's just the canvas. There's no painting yet. There's no revelation and manifestation. Lavan has two daughters. Lavan, God, as he's Keser Atik, has two daughters, a higher Hay and a lower Hay. Before he manifests, he's just that whiteness. There's just God that has no form, no manifestation, no name, no revelation, essence of God, no explanation at all, no way of parameters at all. And that Lavan has two daughters. And by the way, you understand, we're not going to get into this too much tonight, but you all know, those of you that are familiar with the Hasidic writings, but now you're ready, even if you're not, you could understand, based on what we're learning now, that what was Lavan, the whole thing Yaakov was doing with the sheep, right? I'm sure you've heard the idea that when Yaakov was doing the whole thing with the sticks, that whole stick stuff with the sheep, which is really weird, peeling off layers of, I mean, it's like really like, again, like if you're not drinking the Chassidic Kool-Aid and you're like really thinking that Torah's just telling us about like how to like breed sheep. So anyone that learns, so who knows, who remembers, what is the Kabbalah and Chassidic say? What was Yaakov doing with the sticks with the sheep? What do we do every day that's the same thing? No? Tefillin. What we do when we put on tefillin is what Yaakov was doing with the sheep, with the sticks. Again, drawing down from Lavan. Anybody, I don't want to get into it, but in Kabbalah, the akudim, the kudim, brudim, the different types of sheep, spot, speckled, and whatever, I forgot the other one, spot, speckled, and something or the other. Huh?
Ring,
thank you. Spot, speckled, and ring. Akudim, spot, nekudim, and rib. Spot, speckled, and ring. There's a Sherlock Holmes story like that, by the way, right? Speckled something.
Yeah, speckled banner.
Speckled banner, thank you. Spot, speckled, and ring. So according to Kabbalah, according to that Rizal, that's all the worlds. Right? That's one of the sources of all the worlds. He was drawn down from that whiteness. That was Yaakov's whole life. And you understand already what Chassidus is explaining. Let's remind ourselves from the very first Zohar that we just began with tonight. What did Yaakov, what did he say? Yaakov, what did he say to Paro that 130 years he was, what kind of life did Yaakov had? He was suffering. What do you mean he was suffering? Person at that level, what do you mean he was just kvetching to Paro? Kvetching, he comes from a Paro, he's like kvetching. He sounds like a mamash, like an altakak in a nursing home, right? You read it, he comes to Paro, he's like, yeah, I had 130 years, they were pretty bad. So we understand he's not just kvetching. The suffering of his life was that he was the ultimate of the three patriarchs. Yaakov was the greatest. And the suffering of his life was what Avraham began, which was to bring and illuminate God's light in the world. Yaakov knew that he was the, well, he thought that he was the culmination of that. And his suffering was that Rachel was his vehicle to do that. Rachel was the ultimate vehicle to do that, the lower hay, the letters of speech. She was all about that revelation, which we're going to learn very shortly, was her beauty. And she died. And she died. And so when he comes to Paro, and you understand that Paro is the letters Ha'orif, which is the back of the neck, which is very much related to the heel. Paro Ha'orif is the back of the neck and the heel. What do the back of the neck and the heel have in common? All the holy Sfarim teach us. They're the parts of your body that have no expression. Talk about manifesting and revealing yourself. How do you manifest and reveal yourself in the back of your neck or in your heel? You can't. So Yaakov comes in front of Paro and says, my whole life I've been trying to rectify you. We learned last week that he was hoping maybe he'd be able to rectify Esav. Remember last week he learned he sent those impure animals. He thought that maybe he'd be able even to rectify Esav. And he couldn't. He realized that the sheep was still young. And the babies, he wasn't able to bring that rectification. So that's everything was about, yeah, that's everything what he was trying to do with Lavan. That's what Lavan was. And all the stories of the Torah, when you read this way, that's what Lavan chasing Yaakov was all about. The Chernobyl, the Mara 9, speaks about at the end of this week's parasha, when Lavan was chasing Yaakov. So the Chernobyl says, there was still some sparks to be had. There was still that need to bring that rectification somewhere. It's all the stories you read like that. The book of Genesis, really the whole Torah, but the book of Genesis is the story of how God began manifesting in the world. How God created the world through concealing himself, letters of speech, and then began about revealing his letters of thought, etc., and revealing these deeper lights of who he is. And that's what it means that Yaakov loved Rachel. Now, what does this have to do with beauty? What does that have to do with beauty? So in number 7, we're now learning from the Tzemach Tzedek. Number 789 is from the Tzemach Tzedek. In number 7, what the Tzemach Tzedek explains is that what is beauty? What is beauty all about? And this connects very much with what we learned last week. For those that were here, they need of tikkun as opposed to tohu. If you look at the bottom line of number 7, what was Yaakov's, his whole work, his whole life about? Giloy or in sof b'kol minei oifanei ha'eskalalus shoynus lamata dafka. The revelation of God's infinity in many different type of things. In other words, if we speak about what Yaakov's life work was about, which is to draw God and reveal God's infinity in the letters of speech, let me ask you, where do you see more of a revelation of God? When everything is uniform and homogenous? Is that how you pronounce it? Homogenous? Or when there are many different types of things. Well, we all know, let's say even when it comes to a king. Berov am hadras melech. Right? What does it mean? How do you translate? Berov am hadras melech. With the, what? Multitude of a nation is a king glorified. But you know that the multitude of a king, Rov am, doesn't just mean multitude quantitatively. When is a king really glorified? When there's a multitude qualitatively. The greatest teacher is not the one that has the most students. The greatest teacher is the one that's able to speak to a lot of different types of students on a lot of different levels. Why? Because that shows the depth and the profundity of his mind that he could be able to, the words, bekomene iskalus shoynus lamata dafka, to include a lot of different things. And a king that's able to bring peace between a lot of different, a good CEO, if you remember we spoke about last week, we touched on this, a good CEO is one that knows how to spot talent, a lot of different types of talent, and put them all together. And what do you call when you're able to bring a lot of different things together and put them away just perfectly? What do you call that? Beauty. What's Tiferes? What's Pe'er? What is beauty?
Harmony.
Huh?
Harmony.
Harmony. Beauty is the harmonious coming together. The Berov am hadras melech. What does hadar mean? Beautiful. Pre-Eitz Hadar, right? Hadar means beauty. Berov am, the beauty is when there's a lot of different things coming together. When you have a lot of different colors that come right, exactly just right. Physical beauty, he says in number 8, which is a continuation of the same mimer, look where it's underlined. Yifas toyar v'yifas marek. Dainu shehoiseb klula mikol mene gvanam dechesed gvura odoim v'lovan. She was a combination, a harmony of many different colors. That's what the beauty means. Red and white and green. Ben bekelem, which is toyar, ben be'oris, shenikra marek. You know, Rashi even says, let's just talk for a second in the level of pshat. Yerachel was Yefas Toyer of Yefas Mara. What do these words mean? Yefas Toyer is translated as, Rashi says, means the actual physical body, well-built formed, the tzir tmuna sevarim, that there's a harmony of limbs. Again, let's talk, because the physical beauty is the mushal that's being used. What's physical beauty? When the limbs are in congruence and harmonious. Right? That's where physical beauty comes from. Let's talk about a chair for a second. Let's talk about a chair. Let's not get too platonic, but if you take four pieces of blocks of wood and put another piece of wood on it and nail them together, is that a chair? Well, put another piece in back. Is it a chair? It's a chair. You'd call it a chair. And then, I don't know, Louis XIV in Versailles had chairs that are worth today. In the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you have chairs that are worth like $2 million. So they all partake of chairness, right? But what makes one chair more beautiful than the other chair? The harmonious congruence of all the different parts of it. It's not just wood. It's a lot of different colors. It's a lot of different... If you're really Hungarian, you have a lot of different flowers and different engravings and different things, and they all come together. That's beauty. I'm talking about before modern. Modern art's not beauty. I know what modern art is. Forget. But I'm talking about real beauty. All right. Yeah, okay. Modern art is also colors coming together. Fine. I'm not going to get into that debate. But beauty is a congruence. You know, they joke about Kant, which we're going to touch on him tonight a little bit. According to Kant's opinion, the most beautiful music is army marching band music. Which I'm sure most people would not agree with. But in Kant's opinion, army marching bands is mamash like everything, you know, tick-tock. Everything is very mesuder. So you have sounds coming together exactly, you know, like that. So you might disagree with that, but the idea is beauty comes... A harmony is when you have a lot of different sounds. If you're going to force me to use a mashal, Stairway to Heaven is such an important song because it goes through all the different ranges of music. It's one of the reasons it's considered by many to be the greatest song of all time because it does, Dafka does have a lot of different types of beats and ranges, which is a chashuv azach in a song. It is. I don't know what you mean.
It's true.
Yeah, I know. So that's the idea of beauty. Beauty is the well-built form and the beauty of the appearance. It's when you have a perfect harmonious representation. Now, listen carefully. Because here we're coming to the main point over here. So what does it mean that Rachel was beautiful? What does it mean that to reveal God through the letters of speech, to bring God's revelation to the world is ultimate beauty that Leah doesn't have? You understand that? Because in the hidden worlds, in the worlds where everything is just a revelation of God, it's like monotony. It's just one sound. Might be a comforting sound. Om, which is tranquil and comforting. And that's the sound a mother makes to the baby. Comforting and tranquil. But nobody would say that it's beautiful. Right? Beauty comes from a lot of different noises in harmony. And as the Tzemach Tzedek, as the Chassidus explained, that if the purpose is to reveal God's infinite light, in what aspect of this world are you supposed to reveal God's infinite light? All of the aspects. That's beauty. And again, the greater the teacher, the more they're able to speak to all different types of people. Why? Because that shows how deep their knowledge is. By the way, it says Mashiach will be able to teach the secrets of Torah to children. Because that shows you how profound. So what Chassidus explains, listen carefully, and this is an extremely deep idea, all beauty touches the truth of God's infinity. Because the ultimate revelation of God's infinity is when the manifestation of the revealed worlds, all the different details, come together and all of them are screaming what? Hashem Echad. When all the different details of reality will be saying Hashem Echad. When the ultimate beauty, when is God's revelation of His infinity, is the beauty of Mashiach, is that every blade of grass and every person, Jew, Gentile, all levels, everyone, all of reality, not by negating their individuation, but by embracing it, will all scream Hashem Echad, Ushmo Echad. That's beauty. Beauty doesn't come, I'll do it, might as well. Beauty can't come from a ghetto type of existence. That's what Rav Kook speaks about, that the fact that Jews left the ghetto and became part of aesthetic experience is a necessary component in the messianic revelation. And it's a good thing that Tali is here tonight, because Rav Kook says there's nothing. The Rav Kook talks about that for Mashiach to come, there has to be Jewish artists. Rav Kook spoke about there has to be beauty brought back. We lost it. We were living a Leia existence. We were living a letters of speech existence in the ghetto and the shtetl. And beauty comes when Jews are able to live throughout the world. That's what art is. When you have all the different types of existence and creation and bring God's light to all of them and make one harmony of them. That's beauty. What's known in Latin as coincidenta oppositorium. In Latin there's a concept, a mystical concept, coincidenta oppositorium, to be able to bring opposites together is the secret of unity. The secret of unity is when strife is brought to resolution, but more than resolution, when strife is made to become to a harmony. That's the revelation of God's infinity, God's essence. Beauty, anytime you see beauty, you're seeing a way to get to God's essence, which is the source of one of the most radical teachings of Hasidus ever, and one of my personal favorites, is that Yosef was looking at the wife of Potiphar and was enticed by her beauty. And what does the verse say? Vayonos vayetze hachutza. I'm sorry. Well, before that, it says, Chazal say he was enticed by her beauty, but then what does it say? Chazal and Gemara and Soita Rashi brings that how did he save himself? He saw his father's image in the window. And then that allowed him to vayonos vayetze hachutza. He ran out. So you ready for what the Mizrach Magid says? You know who the window was? The wife of Potiphar was that window where he saw Yaakov's image. Because Yaakov is beauty, Yaakov is Tiferes. Yaakov was all about bringing God's revelation in beauty, showing in everything, and every beauty is partaking of that level of Ein Sof. So the Magid says that what Yosef did, and kids don't try this at home. This is one of those things that you know, it's if you're on a high level, I mean, you could do it with art and music for sure, but with physical things, whatever, you get what I mean. So Yosef looked at the wife Potiphar, and instead of being enticed, vayonas ve'etze chutzi, he ran out from the physicality of what she was. By looking at her, she was the window. He saw his father's image in her. She was the window. He used that beauty as a way of cleaving to God's Ein Sof, because every beauty partakes of that ability to harmonize things and reveal God's infinity in the world. And that's how he was able to overcome. And what we're going to learn now, here we go, to turn to the other side of the page. What Chassidus then says is that when Yosef did that, you all know, what appellation did Yosef get from having that experience with the wife of Potiphar? He was called Yosef HaTzadik. And what he explains, I'm not going to even bother reading number 9 inside, you can later if you want, but number 9 with the Tzemach Tzadik explains over there that the Zohar always says, what's Tzadik? Tzadik is Yesod. And the Yesod is Ochid B'Shmayavar, the ultimate connection of heaven and earth. Yosef was the ultimate connection. And what Chassidus explains, if you look at number 9, just the first thing that's underlined, that Yaakov was so upset that Rachel died because he lost her beauty. And what does the Zohar say, the first Zohar that we began with? How do we begin tonight's class? That when he saw Yosef, those 17 years, which of course is Gematria Tov, which means beauty, Tov is light, which is beauty, those 17 years he saw Yosef's beauty, and he felt better. Because what the Tzemach Tzedek explains is that Yosef was also Yefei Torah, Yefei Mara, and Yosef, what he says, if you look just where it's underlined, the third line, Yesh Yosef Maila B'Yosef Mi B'Rachel. Yosef was an even higher beauty than Rachel, which we're not going to have time to get into tonight. Mitzvah Shem, over maybe in another week or two, we'll get to it. Yosef is even more than Rachel. Because Rachel is Malchus Datzilus and Yosef is Yesod Ak, which means Yosef is Soiv of Kolam, and Yosef is Mamish, the revelation of God's essence in the physical. Yosef's beauty made Yaakov feel better. And what does the Zohar say? Remember how we began? When Yaakov saw Yosef, he was fine. It was as if he never suffered in his life. Do you know why? Because Yosef is that beauty, which is why he reached that rectification dafka through the wife of Potiphar, being able to use that beauty. Yosef was the one that actually was able to come to that place and bring the beauty in the lowest place. And Yosef, according to Kabbalah, means coming from that place of Seif Kalaman of Ak, of Adam Kadmon. Yosef is the ultimate revelation, which is why, if you look in the Torah, what do we know about Yosef? Yosef, who am Mashbir, who am Machalkel, he's Yosoid. He's the ultimate one that gives over sustenance to the world. Yosef is the way to bring God to the world. That's what the tzaddik is all about. I'm not making a pitch now for having a Rebbe, a Hasidic Rebbe, but this is what all the writings of Rav Nachman and Likutei Maran and Chabad and all the Hasidim are about, a tzaddik Yosef. The Indian of Yosef is to be able to bring that revelation to the lowest places. Yosef is the ultimate rectification. Yosef comes from even higher than Yudke Vavke. You understand? Yosef comes from the love in itself, which we don't have time to explain. But the bottom line is, therefore, that's the explanation of the Zohar, that this is why Yaakov, when he saw Yosef, it's as if he never suffered in his life. What do you mean he never suffered in his life? You went through 130 years with all this tzaras of Esav, with Rachel dying. What do you mean he never suffered? The answer is, because what's the purpose of Yaakov's life? One thing. Beautifying the world. What's beautifying the world? What's beauty? Making a harmony of all aspects of reality, saying Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad. And when he saw Yosef, who in Egypt, Yosef was in Mitzrayim and maintained as, right, and you know Chassidus actually says that the forefathers were all shepherds, right? Because they were shepherds, they had to live some kind of, they also were somehow Leidic. Yosef wasn't a shepherd, Yosef was on Wall Street. Yosef was a hotshot lawyer or doctor or whatever jobs you happen to have. That's what Yosef was. Yosef was living in the details of Mitzrayim. You know what the uncle says? Layorim ishes yodiv esragle. Without Yosef, Parah says to Yosef, Biladecha layorim ishes yodiv esragle. Without you, nobody will lift their hand and their foot. The uncle says nobody will be able to carry weapons or make a living, do anything. He didn't delegate authority. He was like the administrator, you know, whatever. So that's Yosef, and that beauty, that's the beauty that Yaakov wanted in Rachel. And that's the beauty that was instantiated in its totality in Yosef. Now, to understand a little better, to really appreciate this Hasidic idea of beauty, so we're going to talk a little in philosophy. To be able, I always like to contrast and compare, to be able to really appreciate sometimes what it says in Torah and Hasidus especially. So to see the difference between the way things are is philosophy. So one of the most important philosophers of aesthetics, of beauty, was Schopenhauer. There are different theories of beauty already. Plato speaks about it. There are always ideas of what beauty is, etc. But in modern times, one of the most important aesthetic philosophies is that of Schopenhauer. And to understand what Schopenhauer explains is the purpose of beauty, or even more than purpose, what's the achievement of beauty? What beauty does? So, first to understand Schopenhauer, just a little, very slight introduction, because our time is late and we still have some stuff to learn. But basically what he says is that the world itself, he has a dual perception of reality. In Schopenhauer's philosophy, the world itself is what he calls will, which essentially means the world itself, the cheftza, the object of the world itself, is an insatiable will, is a will that's continuously making us want things, desire things. It's one force that's continuously making us this will to live, will to procreate, will to desire. And this will, which is the essence of what reality is the source of all our suffering. It's a very pessimistic philosophy where essentially he says that the individuation that we usually have of this grueling essence of reality is just this bubbling desire to want stuff, and therefore when we're part of that, we're essentially dog-eat-dog. Because all of reality, he goes right down to the deepest level of consciousness, we think that we're not intellectual, we're not emotional, we're all just desire. Freud was very influenced by Schopenhauer. We're all just essentially eros, desire. That's what all of reality is, and all of reality is just trying to fulfill desire. And therefore, being part of the world as is going to be damning, difficult, and suffering. He was also very influenced by Buddhism, that reality itself is essentially suffering, because all you want is essentially going from wanting one thing to the other, and reality as is continuously going to be trying to struggle for life and to have some kind of respite from this violent, continuous bubbling of this one mass will that we're all part of. And there's no place for free will. This is in his philosophy, he actually quotes Spinoza that says, if you would ask a rock that you threw, if you threw a rock and you were to ask the rock, do you have free will? The rock would say, of course, I elected to fly. And so the same thing these philosophers say is with us. Do you have free will? Yeah, of course, I elected to want to buy, you know, to cheat somebody else out of business or to want to buy new tiles and stuff. Of course I elected. Because the whole world is this one substance of will. And it's a very damning level of subjugation. And basically what Schopenhauer says is there's one main way to be redeemed, to have tranquility and respite from this, and that is reorienting consciousness to leave the feeling of self, of individuation. And that is done through beauty. What Schopenhauer's aesthetic says essentially is that the only way we're ever going to be able to have freedom and tranquility is to leave self, leave a feeling of self. As long as we're focused on self, we're always going to be eaten up and burning with desire for a million things. And we all know that's true. You're always wanting something. I'm waiting for my vacation. I'm waiting for the day to finish. I'm waiting for a million different things, right? Because I'm always wanting something. And as long, even when you're ready, you already made it to, you made it to the, you know, to the Caribbean and you're lying on the beach in some beach chair, I want a pina colada. And then you got your pina colada, oh my God, the Wi-Fi doesn't work in my hotel room. And you're always being part, you're essentially being part of this will, which is the and the only way out of it is by losing self. And that's done through beauty. What Schopenhauer says is that the magic of beauty is that it raises us out of our being, ourselves. I'm going to give you a mushel, and then I'll read a couple lines from Schopenhauer. But the mushel is probably one of my all-time favorite scenes from a movie. I really never chapped what beauty does until I saw Shawshank Redemption. And which is also a hush of a movie, but Bechlal, in that movie, with the many deep ideas that it conveys, there's one scene there which is, it's just unbelievable. There's a scene where the guy, I forgot his name, Tim Robin, whatever, I don't know who he plays, so he breaks into the warden's office and he puts on the loudspeaker Solaria from Mozart. He puts on the Solaria from The Marriage of Figaro from Mozart, and like you see like all the prisoners like stopping and the wardens and the guards, and there's this beautiful area, one of the most beautiful areas from Mozart, Bechlal, and they all just stop, and like everyone is awed by this beautiful music. And then Morgan Freeman says the most beautiful word. Morgan Freeman says, to this day I don't know what those two Italian women were singing about. And I don't want to know. There are some things that are better best let not said in words. But one thing I know is that those minutes when that music was playing, every man in Shawshank was free. Beauty is transcendence. Schopenhauer says what beauty does, when you see a real work of art, you leave self. When you see anything beautiful, it allows you to leave that continuous boiling cauldron of self, of desires. When you see beauty, you go out of who you are. You leave the reality of the world. I'm going to read you a couple of lines. Raised by the power of the mind, a person relinquishes the usual way of looking at things. He does not allow thought to take possession of his consciousness, but instead gives the whole power of his mind to perception. Talking about looking at beauty. Immerses himself entirely in this and lets his whole consciousness be filled with the quiet contemplation of the natural object actually present, whether a landscape, a tree, a hill, a building, or whatever it may be. He loses himself in this object. He forgets his very individuality. The person wrapped in this perception of beauty is no longer individual, but he is a pure, willless, painless, timeless subject of knowledge. You lose yourself and you just become connected to that knowledge, that beauty that you're seeing, that vision that you're having. And he brings a raya of the Dvar of Schopenhauer from Spinoza. It was this that Spinoza had in mind when he wrote, quote, "The mind is eternal so far as it understands under the aspect of eternity." You know how you could partake of eternity? By viewing, by losing yourself in a vision of eternity. Losing oneself in a vision, in beauty, is how one is liberated from the regular mundane consciousness of self. Beauty is transcendence. It's a mode, an escape from reality. It takes one out of reality. Listen to this. Anyone who immerses himself in the contemplation of nature, the beauty of nature, so that he continues to exist only as a pure knowing subject, all you feel is your knowing, your knowledge, your vision of the beauty, that it becomes directly conscious that you now show is dependent, that all of reality is dependent on your existence. You become one with the beauty, you become unified with it. And then he goes on, and he talks about that's an artist. He says that's why almost all artists are mad, are crazy, or at least don't do well in the physical world. You know, absent-minded professor, people that are creative are usually don't do well in the physical world, or are really lousy at time management and stuff like that. Because people that get lost in that vision, because beauty, of course, doesn't just mean, it can mean art, it can mean poetry, it can mean music, it could be ideas, the beauty of an idea. Spinoza's talking about that beauty of an idea. When you get lost in that, he says you go out of the world. Because an artist, he listens to this, he quotes Goethe, "You fix in the lasting thoughts the hovering images that float before the mind, and you become a clear mirror of the essence of the world." An artist is a clear mirror of the essence of the world. You go out of the regular reality, you transcend it. You're free, so you can't be part of it as much. That's Schopenhauer's idea of beauty, which is an absolutely beautiful idea. But what are we learning tonight? Chassidus doesn't argue with that, except with one thing. How is what we learned tonight different than Schopenhauer? Schopenhauer is saying that beauty takes us up out of our regular life. Takes us out of the world. What are we learning tonight? What's beauty? What's Rachel and Yosef's beauty? What's real beauty in the world? The beauty, yes, it's supposed to take you out of feeling as letters of speech as is. But the power of Rachel, the power of beauty, is to bring Ein Sof, God's infinity, into the letters of speech. We don't have that duality of Schopenhauer, which he took from Kant. We don't have that duality of phenomena and noumena. We don't have the duality of world as will or representation. We don't have a duality of world as is and world as how it looks to us. No, the beauty is God's infinity. And the more that you could reveal that harmony in all the details of reality, you're bringing the beauty into the world. Into the world. It's the nullification to Ein Sof in the world. But now we have to go to Reb Tzadik, which is the number 10, which I don't have time to read inside. But Reb Tzadik says something unbelievable. Who brought about the building of Klal Yisrael more? Leah or Rachel? Leah. With all Rachel's beauty, Leah was the real progenitor, the real maker of the Jewish people. She has the Ikar Toldos. She's the mother. What does that mean? So Reb Tzadik says like this, not all of us could be a Yosef HaTzadik. Not all of us could maintain that beauty, that harmony, when in the house of the wife of Potiphar. Those of us that are lawyers and doctors and go to Wall Street or happen to eat tuna fish sandwiches or anything when you're involved in the physical world, you can't always maintain that beauty. Sometimes we get pretty ugly. And it's a, what's the word, cacophony? Cacophony. It's not a harmonious noise. Sometimes our world is very not beautiful and we mess up. And we're in that ace of world of Tohu, which we spoke about last week, where everything is shattered into a million pieces. So Reb Tzadik says, again, based on the Zohar, what the Zohar is saying is that there's an even deeper way that we could get close to God, which Yaakov didn't like in the beginning. In fact, he hated it because it's not beautiful. And you know what that is? It's by, after sinning and messing up and not being beautiful, going into the back into the depth of who you are, retreating into the depth of who you are, and there finding God. Because that's Leah. The crying of Leah is that depth of her being the letters of thought, of her being completely within God. And you know that that's what the Sfarim say, the Ramban brings it, that there are four wheels in God's chariot. Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and David. And King David wasn't beautiful. He might have began life as beautiful, but he messed up in a lot of ways. Yet he was also part of the divine chariot. And the whole struggle, there's always a struggle between the children of Leah and the children of Rachel. There's always a struggle between their kids, whether it's the Yosef and his brothers, whether it's Yehuda and Yosef and Parshas Vayigash, where's the clash of Yehuda and Yosef, whether it's the whole history of the Jewish people, when the kingdom was split into two, base, right, Yisrael and Yehuda. Who split the kingdom into two? Yeravim ben Nevat, who came from Ephraim. This perpetual struggle is the ultimate purpose to beautify the world, or is it to go back into God? To go back into your mother? To go back into the womb? People don't like going back into the womb. They like beauty. But Reb Tzadik says, look inside by the number 10, in the top line, Bidas b'nei Adam ain't about tshuva k'maya tzadik gomor. Most people think about tshuva is not as great as a tzadik gomor. Ve'ein tzarech leimer shu chatoim shasek var chashuvim kezachiyas. And how much more when you look back at all the sins that you did and all the times you messed up and all the times that you were really, really ugly. Reb Tzadik says, ain't tzarech leimer, that most people look back at them even though you did tshuva. You look back at them and you're still embarrassed of them. Chazal say that your sins become merits and they become even greater than mitzvahs you do, but we still don't believe it because Leah is hated. We want to always be perfect. We want to always have that beautiful life where everything fits into place. We always want that lower hay. We always want to see that beauty in our lives. But Reb Tzadik says it's not going to work. Because what the ugliness do is, number one, I'm not going to read it inside, but if you look, what he says is that tshuva is this hidden world. Tshuva is going back into that womb. Going back into that womb. Did I circle it on the bottom? Yeah, all the way in the bottom where I circled it. Ube'emes hi leya imoy. Because what happens is when you do a sin, you have to go back into God. Back into that letters of thought. What's tshuva? Tshuva is the opposite of beautifying the world. Think for a second. What do you do when you do tshuva? You go into yourself. You return into yourself to come back to relationship with God. You retreat back into self and your connection with God. You didn't manage in Ashes Potiphar's house. You didn't manage on Wall Street. You messed up when you were there. You messed up in that beauty. You didn't do beauty. You made ugliness. So it makes you go back into God. And that's what Reb Tzadik says. That's what it means that Leah was like the mother. Yaakov didn't want to go back up to his mother. He didn't want to go back into God's infinity as is. He didn't want that. He wanted beauty. But what he had need to learn, Reb Tzadik says, look on the left side, the left column, where there's the asterisk over there. I'm going to read this inside because it's unbelievable. Listen to this. This is one of those things that if anyone would write this today, they'd be excommunicated or certainly thrown out of a shul. But Reb Tzadik says, through the sin and repenting, all your vitality comes from. All your geshmak in serving God is after you sinned and repented. It's only by singing and sinning and then repenting you come to an even deeper connection with God. Achsani kubar nash aryan di'imei, but most people hate the nakedness of their mother. Umiteva adam shesayna tshuva alara, most people are embarrassed of their past even though they did tshuva on it. They don't want to talk about it. That's what it means that they hate the nakedness of their mother. Afa pisha ze ikar shemidre al mashahu. Hear what those words say? You know how existential those words are? How do you translate them? Huh? They made you what you are. They're your mother. They made you what you are. The mistakes of your past when it was ugly. Yaakov also didn't like the idea. But those mistakes, that ugliness of the past is what builds Klal Yisrael. That's David HaMelech. That's Yehuda and Tamar. Yosef didn't do it sin. Yosef is beautiful. He didn't. But you know where Mashiach comes from? The daughters of Lot, Yehuda and Tamar. All the stories in the Bible that we skipped in Hafter. Right? All those stories. Lot and his daughters, Yehuda and Tamar, David and Bathsheba, Rus and Boaz. All the things, all the stories where this seems to be the ugliness of the Bible. And I guess here you could say that bigger taka means bigger. Because what it's telling you over here is that when you mess up and then you come back into yourself and back up to God in the deepest way, that makes you who you are. But we don't want to be connected to that. So therefore we understand, if I'm to ask you as we finish tonight, who do you want to marry, Rachel or Leah? And the answer has to be, obviously, that the only way to build Klal Yisrael is both. Lavan has two daughters, there are two Hays. And we have to marry both. We might want to marry Rachel, because she's beautiful, because that's a wonderful life where everything makes sense. And yes, we have to have that also. We have to like Yaakov. We have to learn that Yaakov wanted that. So like Yaakov, we have to want to marry Rachel. We have to want that lower hay. We have to want our lives to be beautiful. We have to try as much as we can to marry Rachel and then see the beauty of Yosef. We have to try to make things work and get our stuff together. We have to try to work out that things should be beautiful, that when we go to our job and we're hanging out with Gentiles, we should make a Kiddush Hashem and we shouldn't, you know, even if you have to go to a cousin of mine just told me that where she has to go on business meetings. I don't even want to say in a shul where she has to go. It's not just a bar. V'chule. She has to go in business meetings in these places. So we'd like to always remain married to Rachel. We'd like to always be beautiful. We'd like to even bring God into that heel. We'd like to bring that harmony and that beauty. But we also have to know that we might not like it, but there are times that we also have to be married to Leah. We have to know to go back into ourselves, because there we find the deepest revelation of God's essence. That's our mother. That's the source of our invigoration. That's the source of inspiration. That renews ourselves. That makes us born again. And we go deep and we find God in ourselves. It's not beautiful to go back into letters of thought. When you go into letters of thought, it's not beautiful. People aren't impressed. It's not as impressive as the world of Rachel, of the revealed world. But sometimes you have to go back into yourself and find God there. You're not always able to make the world beautiful. No, sometimes you have to run into the world of Leah and cry with her eyes, the deepest eyes of Leah, and see God as God is, the essence of who you are. That's tshuva. And it might be like going back into your mother. It's going back into the divine womb. But only there can we become born again and then once again marry Rachel and try again to bring the world to a state of beauty. We should be zeichet to marry both Rachel and Leah. We should be zeichet to live with both hays of Hashem's name and thereby rectify God's name when we try to bring these two worlds together, when Yosef and Yehuda, when Eitz Yosef and Eitz Ephraim will, and Eitz Yehuda will be together again with the coming of Mashiach Tzidkenu b'mehar Amenu, Amen v'Amen. Well, I'm sorry for going over time.